Sally and I think we're in the same exact time slot last year in a different session, so here we are 1 year later, so it's a pleasure to be here. And my title of my presentation was originally supposed to include district policies, but I sort of ran out of time, so I'm going to focus on state laws and their alignment with the USDA interim final rule on competitive foods. I have no financial disclosures to reveal for this presentation. So for those of you who are not familiar with the USDA standard, I'm going to kind of give you a little backdrop and a little history. For those of you who are quite intimately familiar, I apologize if I'm going to bore you with the first couple of slides. But I'll provide a rationale for why USDA has issued a rule in this area, what the major components of the rule are, and then really focus on what we looked at for this, which was the extent to which existing state laws already align with some of the components of the USDA rule, just so we can see how far the states have to go in terms of implementation of the USDA rule. I'll also make some reference to what I know about district policies because I, for those of you who don't know, I do lead the largest ongoing nationwide evaluation of the congressionally mandated school district wellness policy. So I do have some insights into where districts stand in this area too, so I'll be happy to share this with you. And then really talk about the opportunities that exist going forward and how existing state laws in this area could serve as a facilitator or a barrier to implementation of what USDA is going to do during next school year. So how did we get where we are today? Many of you probably are familiar with the USDA's Food of Minimal Nutritional Value rule, which has been in place for a number of years, decades in fact. And that law basically prohibited the sale of carbonated beverages and selected candies, like jelly candies and things like that, in competition with the federal school meal programs at the same time as meals were being served or sold. And that was really the only federal rule governing the sale of snack foods and beverages outside of the meal program at the federal level. Snack foods and beverages sold outside the meal program are considered competitive foods because they're sold in competition with the meal program. Competitive food venues typically include vending machines, a la carte lines in the cafeteria, school stores. They've also been defined to include fundraisers, parties, and food as a reward in the classroom. The Child Nutrition and WIC Reauthorization Act of 2004, for the first time, required all school districts in the U.S., public and private, that participate in any of the federal child nutrition programs. That would include the meal programs, the milk program, the after-school snack program, the summer food service program, to adopt and implement a wellness policy by the first day of the 2006-07 school year. Required to be included in that wellness policy were guidelines regarding the sale of foods and beverages on campuses outside of the meal program. They were specifically just required to adopt guidelines. It wasn't anything definitive. It wasn't anything required. After the wellness policy provisions took effect in school year 2006-07, we did a number of studies over the years, and we still do them, where we looked at kind of the progress that districts have taken and states have taken in adopting these wellness policies and the competitive food provisions in particular. And our work pretty much illustrated that the weakest component of the district wellness policies really has been in the competitive food area. And that information, along with a plethora of research that was really emerging since the passage of the Child Nutrition and WIC Reauthorization Act, showed that while there's been a lot of progress in a number of jurisdictions across the country with regard to competitive foods, there was still a lot of opportunity that existed to change the competitive food environment and to improve the nutritional value of foods and beverages sold in these venues. And that really is what led up to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010. And the provisions in it that specifically authorized the USDA for the first time to develop regulations to create nationwide standards governing the sale of competitive foods in schools during the school day. The law was written such that it would not be preemptive of any existing state laws or district policies that are stronger than or at least meet the standard of USDA's rule. But no state laws or district policies could be weaker than, or the ones that were weaker than, would be preempted by the USDA rule. I'm going to talk today about the rule itself and then state laws. The Child Nutrition and WIC Reauthorization Act of 2004 really served as a focusing event for state action in this area too. And that's really when we started to see quite a bit of uptake in state law in this area. And I and my colleagues have published some papers over the years that have basically shown that district policies with regard to competitive foods in particular tend to be stronger in states with strong laws in this area, which is not surprising. We also find that implementation at the school level tends to be higher and more likely to occur in jurisdictions where there's a strong state standard and a strong district standard in this area. Why does Congress and why does USDA care about competitive foods? Well, as you can see from this slide alone, and this is from one of the projects that I work on, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Support Bridging the Gap project at UIC. As you can see from this slide, less healthy competitive foods and beverages are ubiquitous in U.S. Schools at all grade levels, elementary, middle, and high. The brown bars, bars on the left hand of each column are high school, the blue ones are middle school, and the goldish ones are elementary school. And so you can see the sale of competitive foods are particularly ubiquitous at the secondary school levels, but much to many people's surprise, unhealthy competitive foods are still being sold in elementary schools, and Poonam and some of my colleagues, Lindsay Turner and others, have done some work in that area in particular. So what are some of the key provisions in the USDA rule? The rule, interim final rule, was issued on June 28, 2013, after a rather lengthy, public comment period. The original proposed rule was issued in February, and surprisingly to me, the public comment period went through pretty fast, and an interim final rule was issued in June. And the comments that were issued in response to the proposed rule, the biggest concerns related to implementation and compliance, and I will talk about that at the end of the session today. So let me quickly run through for you what the guidelines are. The first ones are something that all of the products are supposed to contain. So they're supposed to contain a grain product, contain 50% or more whole grains by weight, or at least have whole grain as a first ingredient, or, big or, have a first ingredient, one of the major non-grain major food groups, including fruits, veg, dairy, protein, or be a combination food containing a quarter cup of fruit and or vegetable, or contain at least 10% of the RDA of a nutrient of public health concern based on the most recent dietary guidelines. In addition to those specific snack guidelines, there are very specific nutrient guidelines for all snack foods, and there are separate guidelines for beverages. So for sugars, any snack product may contain no more than 35% of total weight of total sugars, and no more than 35% of total calories in fats, and less than 10% of total calories must be from saturated fat, and they must be trans fat free. There are some minimal exemptions for both nutrients, regards to nuts and seeds and things like that. Sodium, that is an area with very little policy traction at the state or local levels. They set different standards, and that one was going to be phased in over time, I think partly due to some lobbying efforts in this area. So up until June 30, 2016, snack foods may not contain any more than 230 milligrams of sodium, and after July 1st, 2016, no more than 200 milligrams. Entrees are set at a different level. So competitive food entrees would be like buying a slight extra slice of pizza a la carte outside of the meal program. That would be considered an entree. Calories, no more than 200 calories per portion as per packaged or served. And beverage guidelines, beverages are pretty much limited to plain water, 100% juices, caffeine-free in middle and high school or middle and elementary schools, and 1% are skim milk or nutritionally equivalent milk alternatives. At the high school level, they also do allow some additional exceptions, so they allow for low-cal isotonic or sports drinks or energy drinks or sweetened teas as long as they're low-cal, 40 calories or less for 8 ounces or 60 calories or less for 12-ounce servings. They also allow flavored and or carbonated water and other calorie-free beverages that are less than 5 calories per 8-ounce serving with a maximum of 20 ounces. For all grade levels, they include portion sizes as well for things except water. So how do the state laws align with these standards? And this is something I've actually been exploring with Betsy Pickertz from my team, who's an attorney. And we've also looked at this in conjunction with Jessica Dunsey-Black at Pew and her staff. So let me tell you a little bit about where I got the data from. The state law data are primary legal research that we conducted using Westlaw and LexisNexis. We looked at all codified statutory, which are legislative bills and laws, and all administrative regulatory laws, including board policies adopted by state boards of education that were embedded by reference into the codified state law. That would include, like, Connecticut, that has some pretty strong nutrition standards that are not codified into regulation, but are separate policies adopted by the board, but are referenced in the state law itself. We looked at all laws effective as of the beginning of school year 2012-13. We used the day after Labor Day as our proxy for the first day of the 2012-13 school year. And we reviewed them for their alignment with USDA. So even though these laws were on the books before USDA came out with their interim rule, it provides a really interesting baseline to see where states stood prior to USDA's interim rule, which is slated to take effect in the beginning of the 2014-15 school year. So we'll have some nice baseline data showing where we stood, and we'll be able to follow this going forward. We looked at the laws in three categories. Basically, do they fully meet the USDA standard on each of the nutrient and beverage provisions? Do they partially meet it? When they partially meet it, it usually means that they provide exceptions for certain grade levels, like high school, or they provide exceptions for certain locations, like vending machines or school stores or something like that. And then we have a group of states whose laws don't meet USDA, but they have another state standard, and they might be on the verge of meeting USDA if they just took it up a notch. And then we have a group of states whose laws address the topic, but they don't require it in any way, shape, or form. So I'll go topic by topic, and I apologize. It's a little hard to see this on the slide, but fortunately I have the numbers here. The one thing I should note is that there is a green bar that may not show up. It's the fully meet category, and in this area of grains, fruit and veg, and RDA, no state meets the fruit and veg, grain, and or RDA requirements of USDA. There is one state that meets the fruit and veg requirement partially based on location. The rest of them have their own requirements, or they encourage it, but they don't really get to the level of USDA. Story gets a little bit different. Oh, good, you can see the green. Story gets a little bit different when you get to sugar and fat. And I should note, and some of you may have seen some of my prior research in this area, but I should note that sugars and fats, restrictions on sugar and fats in competitive foods are the most widely regulated area in state and district policies in this area. So it wasn't surprising to me that there actually are some states that are already meeting the USDA standard in this area. So you can see 4 states meet it for sugars, 5 for fats, and 6 for trans fats, and 1 for saturated fat. The bars right above it, the 3 for sugars, the 6 for fats, the 2 for saturated, and the 4 for trans. Those states partially meet the USDA, meaning they provide some exceptions for certain grade levels or for location of sale. The other ones have a state law that doesn't meet USDA that's either required or in orange that suggests something. Sodium, this one actually surprised me that there were even any states that fully met USDA, only because sodium is very weakly addressed in most state laws and certainly district policies. Massachusetts is actually the state that meets. So here we are in this great state of Massachusetts, and I'm a diehard Red Sox fan, so I'm very happy. Massachusetts is actually the state that meets the snack requirement, and they also meet the entree, along with 2 other states and 5 that meet the calories per serving requirement. Beverages are a totally different ballgame. And when we look at beverages, there are a lot of states that have their own standard. Those are the ones that are the 15, the 8, the 10, the 18, and the 8. They have their own standard, but it doesn't meet USDA. Quite a bit of states meet the standards for only water, for water, fruit, 1% or fat-free milk, and 100% juice, but only 2 states actually specifically require only water, only 100% juice, and or only 1% or fat-free milk. And then when we look at other beverage restrictions related to caffeine, portion sizes, and calories per serving at the high school level, you can see there that there are 8 states that meet the caffeine and 4 states that meet the portion size requirements. 10 states have standards governing fewer calories per serving at the high school level, but no state comes close to meeting USDA. And there are some states that have their own standards in this area. They just aren't quite at the USDA level. So why do we care about all this, and what are the implications for USDA going forward? As I mentioned earlier, the public comments submitted in response to the USDA proposed rule at the time were very concerned about implementation compliance. What I found from my research, as I mentioned earlier, is that compliance at the school level tends to be greater in jurisdictions where you have multiple layers of policy that people are enforcing. So if they have a district policy, if they have a state policy, now if they have a federal policy, it facilitates implementation because decision makers at all levels are really involved with what they're implementing. Thank you. The good news, as we saw, some states are already meeting USDA on certain provisions, so like sugars and fats and trans fats in particular, and a few of the beverage provisions. The okay news is that other states have their own standards, which might easily be nudged up a little bit. They already have standards in place. So maybe their sodium standard is less than or equal to 300 milligrams. To bring it down to 240 or 200 may not be as hard of a sell as starting completely from scratch where they haven't done any implementation on sodium in foods whatsoever. The not so good news is that no state currently meets all the USDA standards whatsoever. So it means that there's a long way to go with regard to implementation across the country of USDA. And I can tell you that the state laws are stronger than district policies. So if no state's meeting it, there are very few districts in the country that will be meeting USDA at this point in time. So what direction will states head? There are a couple of different ways to go. Starting at the top of the triangle, states could actually change their law to match USDA, which some states are already starting to do, just so that they have the same law in the books as USDA, because people at the local level tend to like to follow what their state law is or what their district policy is. Going down to the bottom right, which I apologize, you really can't see it, but some states have actually have some provisions which are stronger than the USDA, and other states have had some discussions about strengthening some of their provisions to go beyond USDA. One of the most notable things about USDA is that it's silent on issues related to fundraisers, classroom parties, and food as a reward, the kind of hot-button political issues. One of my biggest concerns is whether or not the vending machine issue will turn into a fundraiser loophole, and I don't know how that's going to work, but it's a possibility. But there are some states who I think will actually strengthen their law beyond USDA, and because USDA is not preemptive, that's completely doable. And then the bottom left, some states won't do anything. They'll just leave it alone. They'll let USDA do the implementation and let USDA be responsible. And if people don't comply, people don't comply. And then there'll be other states that will do a combination of things. I personally view a couple of different levels of implementation challenges based on where states stand with their existing laws, just based on my work in this area. I think the areas that will have the highest problem with your implementation will be the states with no laws in the area or states with weak laws that only encourage standards. I think you'll have moderate challenges with implementation in states with requirements that are currently weaker than USDA. And I think they'll probably have the easiest time with implementation in jurisdictions that are already meeting the USDA and certain provisions or with provisions that are currently stronger than USDA. So this will all be continued. USDA, as I said, is scheduled to begin implementation next school year. And there's plenty of opportunities for advocates in the room and in the field looking to build on USDA and to align their laws with USDA. And we'll just have to wait and see what happens. So with that, I'd like to just thank my co-authors, Betsy Pinkertz and Frank Chalupka, and acknowledge the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for the funding. Thanks very much. I don't know if there are any questions. I think there's time for a question at this point. Is there time for a question or no?
Maybe we can take one question.
Okay. Hi.
Jamie, do you know if there's an evaluation being planned to assess the implementation of the
USDA is going to be working on CINDA 5, and so I imagine that they'll incorporate some of it through what's happening with CINDA 5. There are those of us who are researchers who are planning our own evaluations through normal research mechanisms, NIH and elsewhere. I don't know, I don't work for USDA, so I can't speak on behalf of them in terms of what their planned evaluation is.